So this is the final chapter then of the unit. And this has to do with membrane structure and function. We're looking at a little piece of phospholipid bilayer right here in slide one. This really isn't new information at all. We've talked about all this before. The phospholipid bilayer is the main substructure of a complete cell membrane or plasma membrane. And keep in mind that it forms automatically without any living thing involved, simply because of the fact that phospholipids individually are examples of molecules that are partly polar and partly nonpolar. Part of the molecule is polar, a different part of the same molecule is nonpolar. And what do we call those kind of molecules? What's the name that describes that sort of molecule that's partly polar and partly nonpolar? Anyone remember? It's amphipathic, which literally means having dual feelings, because the polar part of an amphipathic molecule, its feeling is that it wants to be around other polar things. And the nonpolar part of that same molecule wants to be around other nonpolar things, but neither of them wants to be around the opposite type of thing. So that's why a phospholipid bilayer forms. And in the cartoon form, any book will use the same cartoon, basically. A single phospholipid always has a more or less circular head, which is the polar part, and two tails. What are the tails made out of? Fatty acids, just like the fatty acids in fats. But that's the big distinction between a fat, which is a triglyceride or a triacylglycerol, and a phospholipid, right? They both share a glycerol, which has three connection points, but in a fat, all three connection points are made with fatty acids. In a phospholipid, two are made with fatty acids, and the third is made with a phosphate group, which is charged, and that's what gives the head polarity. So the heads are polar, they like being around the water, whether it's exterior or interior to the cell. And the tails are basically trying to avoid the water. That's why the bilayer forms. And just remember that the words hydrophobic and hydrophilic are used to denote polar and nonpolar, respectively. Hydrophobic literally means water-loving. That's polar things. They like being around water because water is polar. Hydrophobic, literally water-fearing, describes nonpolar things. And why are these tails, by the way, hydrophobic? I mean, I just told you that they're hydrophobic because they're nonpolar, but why are they nonpolar? That's true, but what about a fatty acid makes it hydrophobic or nonpolar? What is a fatty acid when you really get down to it? It's a hydrocarbon, almost. A hydrocarbon for almost all of its length, and then a carboxyl at the end, right? Which is what it uses to make the connection with glycerol. So if it weren't for that carboxyl, it would truly be a hydrocarbon, and hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar, because carbon and hydrogen have the same electronegativities, or very close to the same. Let's go to slide two and see what I've told you before, but it's a good picture, namely that if you're going to have a membrane be part of a living cell, it can't be purely phospholipids. Because a phospholipid bilayer by itself will make a nice bag. That's how the first cells came into existence, without any life. But that's a bag made out of membrane that is nothing but phospholipids, and therefore some things will pass through it, some things won't, and some of those things that can't get through it are things that a cell, to be alive, needs to get through it, either into or out of the cell. So in addition to the phospholipid bilayer, there are other kinds of things embedded in a living cell's membrane, including, importantly, various kinds of proteins, which are what all these purple things are. It's not the only other ingredients, but proteins are important membrane ingredients. And keep in mind that these proteins are described as membrane-bound proteins, right? Not membrane-bounded. Membrane-bounded means membrane-enclosed, like an organelle that has its own membrane. membrane bound means bound to or tied to a membrane, part of the membrane. All right, go on to three. If you use a careful technique, namely freeze fracturing, you get the membrane cold enough, you can very carefully separate the two monolayers that make up a bilayer. The bilayer is two monolayers thick of phospholipids, but the phospholipids all arranged in the same direction are one monolayer. And if you do that, there are various proteins that we just named membrane-bound proteins a minute ago, but when you freeze, fracture, and separate the monolayers, you can see that the interior monolayer, meaning the monolayer that's in contact with the intracellular fluid, features a lot more proteins than the exterior monolayer. That's shown in cartoon form, but it's also shown in real photomicrographs. The little studded appearance here are proteins. There's a hell of a lot more proteins on the intracellular surface, the cytoplasmic surface, as it's called in that picture. And that should make sense, right? There's a lot more going on chemically inside a cell than outside a cell. And various proteins that are part of the membrane are involved in those chemical reactions. Okay, now to four. The actual construction or structure of a plasma membrane is described by what we call the fluid mosaic model. And I don't think I've mentioned this at all before, right? It's a good descriptor of a plasma membrane if you pay attention to the words, which you always should, of course. What is a mosaic? Just outside of biology, just ordinary language. That's right. It's a piece of artwork in which it could be just about anything, but typically it's little pieces of glass or tile. Each one is like a dot on the picture, on the overall picture that will be made eventually, but you make those by gluing them onto a surface, like a wall, for instance. That's a mosaic. Well, mosaic describes a plasma membrane well because each individual phospholipid is like a stone in the mosaic. Here we're looking at an edge view, but you could be looking at a top view from outside of the cell. You're looking down on all those heads, those phospholipid heads. Just like looking at heads of people if you look down on a crowd like at a concert, right? It's kind of a mosaic. So that's why that word is used. But unlike a mosaic artwork in which the pieces are glued in place and don't change positions, the phospholipids and not only the phospholipids, all of the ingredients of the plasma membrane, but including the phospholipids, are not held in place. This bilayer forms because of tails trying to avoid water, right? But that does not mean that individual phospholipids are connected to each other. They are not bonded together. They're simply where they are to keep the tails away from water. And since they are not chemically bonded, they're still individual molecules, each phospholipid, and they can easily change places with each other, just like if you look down on that concert mass of people, from moment to moment, they're not going to be in exactly the same position, right? They're able to walk around. Well, that's what this lateral movement that's labeled here within a monolayer of the bilayer is referring to. And it might surprise you just how movable these phospholipids are in a cell's membrane. 10 million times per second these things switch positions. So they're milling around continuously. That's the fluid part of the phrase fluid mosaic. Fluid means always changing. Not only is the membrane continuously changing, everything inside the cell itself is changing. It's a highly dynamic structure. It's not just an empty, just a random bag of stuff. So there's easy lateral movement, which makes sense because when you have lateral movement within a monolayer, you're not really changing anything about the tails avoiding water, right? just like all the feet on the people standing in a crowd are always on the ground no matter where they are.
Much less often, though, there can be a flip-flop.
In which case, a phospholipid in one monolayer trades places with a phospholipid in the other monolayer. Why does it make sense that that's much more rare, once a month about? What would have to happen for that to take place that makes it unlikely? If you forced that to happen, imagine doing that. What would be wrong with that? Why would there be resistance? What about them? Well, maybe, but think of it the other end. The heads are polar. They're hydrophilic, right? To do this flip-flop, you would have to, at least temporarily, while you're doing the flip, expose this head of the top monolayer to these tails, which are the hydrophobic part of the layer of the bilayer, right? The heads don't want to be around the tails. And similarly for the other one, you'd have to at least momentarily expose it to this hydrophobic environment. And once you kind of got it halfway, then it would flip automatically, right? Because it's trying to get back to a place around water. It happens every once in a while, but it's pretty rare. Okay, the middle part B of this figure has to do with fluidity of the membrane. So we described it as the fluid mosaic. But just how fluid a cell membrane or a plasma membrane is can vary from moment to moment. For one thing, it can the fluidity refers to how loose or how tight it is, basically. And it can be too loose or too tight to function adequately for a membrane as a membrane, which is a selectively permeable membrane, right? A barrier, I mean. So there can be variables of the environment that can affect the fluidity, like temperature, for instance, right? Colder things get, the more things tighten up. The warmer things get, the more loose it's going to get. So the cell needs to be able to adjust the fluidity to counteract changes that are too drastic in the other direction. In other words, if it tightens up too much, like if it gets too cold, it needs to make the membrane more fluid to make it just right for a living cell. And the way a cell can adjust fluidity is by adjusting its components. Are you raising your hand?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, you said cells need to be able to adjust fluidity in order to counteract what?
Changes in the fluidity due to just the environment itself. So if it gets too cold, for instance, that's going to make it too tight, and therefore the cell wants to loosen it back up. Now think back to when we talked about fats, also known as triglycerides or triacylglycerols. They're made out of glycerol and three fatty acids, but we talked about fatty acids individually as being either saturated or unsaturated, right? And if they are unsaturated, which means they have at least one double bond, that double bond or double bonds forms bends, a bend or a bends in the fatty acid tail. Well, if the cell wants to loosen up its membrane because it's too tight, and remember, membrane material is continuously being moved around from organelles to the plasma membrane and back, and we talked about that. So the cell is always adjusting which phospholipids are part of the membrane. It can loosen it up specifically by inserting a bunch of phospholipids that have unsaturated fatty acid tails in them and therefore kinked, which don't fit together as tightly. Right? That's going to loosen it. On the other hand, if it gets too loose, like if it's too hot, then the cell can do the opposite and make it mostly saturated fatty acid phospholipids, which pack together nice and tightly. The bottom figure, C, really applies only to animals. Animals make cholesterol, and we've talked about how that is vitally important for animals because it serves as a precursor to all the steroid hormones. That's just one reason why we can't live without it. Also, cholesterol is important in animal cells as a component of the plasma membrane. It affects the permeability and the fluidity because cholesterol molecules basically take up little places, little gaps within the membrane, as you see in this picture. So that wouldn't be happening in a plant, for instance, because plants don't make cholesterol, but they make similar sterols called phytosterols. Remember that phyto means plant. Alrighty, let's go to 5 now. So I just described the fluid mosaic model of plasma membrane structure. That is a scientific hypothesis, and any hypothesis in science, of course, needs to be testable through experimentation. So this is the results of an experiment to test the predictions of the fluid mosaic model. Using two different cells here, a mouse cell and a human cell, each individually has various proteins, membrane-bound proteins, in other words, proteins that are part of the membrane. And of course, a mouse cell has at least some proteins that are different from a human cell's proteins. Before the experiment, they experimentally, chemically marked these. They didn't actually make them magenta and periwinkle, but they marked them chemically so they could keep track of where the proteins are at any given moment. And then they fused the two cells. So now you have one cell that's partly mouse and partly human. And if the fluid mosaic model were not true, then which would mean that the individual components of the membrane are not moving around, then you would expect to come back later and see a cell that on one side is nothing but mouse proteins and on the other side is nothing but human proteins. But on the other hand, if it's true, then you would expect them to move around. And that's exactly what they found. After an hour, you have a cell that, no matter which side you look at, it's a combination of mouse and human proteins. That will happen only if the proteins are able to move around side to side within the monolayer, within the bilayer, I should say. All right, so fluid mosaic model seems to be the truth. Let's go to 6. This is kind of a catch-all picture. We've looked at similar pictures before, the proteins in both outside and inside the cell, but the focus of this slide is the proteins that are actually part of the membrane itself, which are the so-called membrane-bound proteins. So keep in mind the difference between those phrases, membrane-bound and membrane-bounded. These are membrane-bound proteins, meaning tied to the membrane. They are part of the membrane. Membrane-bounded describes organelles enclosed by their own membrane. So membrane-enclosed and membrane-bounded really mean the same thing. But membrane-bound means connected to the membrane itself, and therefore part of the membrane. Well, there's all kinds of different proteins that are membrane-bound and for different reasons, but regardless of what they actually function as, you can classify them for a totally different reason based on how far, if at all, they penetrate through the thickness of the membrane itself. And so either outside or inside, in this case inside, in the picture as an example, some membranes are associated just with the polar heads of one monolayer or the other. And those are called peripheral proteins. Peripheral is the adjective of periphery, which just simply means the edge of something. So these are membrane-bound proteins. They're connected to the membrane, but they're really just on one face of it or the other. They're not really contributing to the overall integrity of or structure of the membrane. And I use that word integrity because that's why these other kinds of proteins that penetrate into the thickness of the membrane itself are called integral proteins. They contribute to the overall integrity of the membrane. So those are two broad subclasses of membrane-bound proteins, either peripheral or integral. Now, every one of the integral proteins that you see here are not only integral, but you can subdivide integral into two. There's a specific subclass of integral proteins. And every one of these is an example. Because every one of these integral proteins, which means the ones that aren't just on one surface, these, the ones that are not peripheral, stick all the way through the thickness, you can see, right? This is a protein that the same protein is in contact directly with the fluid outside and the fluid inside because it sticks all the way through the thickness of the bilayer. Well, obviously that's an integral protein, right? That's part of the integrity of the membrane. But even more specifically, since it goes all the way through the thickness, it's called a transmembrane protein. Trans meaning across. So it crosses the entire thickness of the membrane. Not all integral proteins are transmembrane proteins. They happen to all of the integral proteins in this figure happen to be transmembrane. But if you imagine one of these purple proteins going maybe a little bit more than halfway through the thickness. And so they're exposed to tails. They're not peripheral proteins that are just skating on the heads. They go into the thickness, but not all the way through. Then they would still be classified as integral. They just wouldn't be transmembrane. And depending on the job that the cell has, the protein has to do, that might be important. For instance, as we'll look at, you have to be a transmembrane protein to do certain functions. We'll look at functions in a second. Let's go to slide 7. This is a different representation of a transmembrane protein using the ribbon model. And I mentioned that the ribbon model is useful because it reminds us of the fact that a single polypeptide is one non-branching linear arrangement of amino acids. But this gives you a good view of secondary structure, right? Because secondary structure has to do with alpha helices and beta pleated sheets. Well, this has a lot of alpha helices, and they're arranged more or less like the staves of a barrel with a hollow interior. So this is a complicated one long amino acid going back and forth through the thickness of the membrane several times. But because of its arrangement, it has a hollow interior and therefore acts as a channel through which just the right kind of particles can get through the membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. Okay, now let's look at functions in slide 8, specifically functions of membrane-bound proteins. There's 6 major categories of functions, one of which is transport. And by transport here, I'm talking about transmembrane transport, meaning transport either into or out of the cell, but through the membrane, the plasma membrane. Some things go through a membrane simply by going directly through the phospholipid bilayer itself. And that's fine if those things are able to. Other things, though, can't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer itself. And yet, they have to be either input or exported out of the cell for the cell to remain alive, which is why I say a working, complete plasma membrane can't just be phospholipids. That's going to lock certain things out or in that have to be gotten into or out. And therefore, you need the help of a transport protein, as they're called, to allow things, those things that can't get directly through the phospholipid bilayer into or out of the cell. All right, so transmembrane transport is a major function of membrane-bound proteins. Others are part of the membrane but act as enzymes. Now, any enzyme, whether it's membrane-bound or fully inside the cell, is acting as a catalyst. That's what an enzyme is by definition. A catalyst is a helper molecule. It's not a reactant, but it helps. It speeds up a reaction millions of times faster than it would happen without the help of the enzyme. And so, really, the membrane-bound enzymes are not doing anything fundamentally different from the enzymes that are completely inside the cell. They just happen to be connected to the membrane while they're doing it. Next is signal transduction. Signal transduction refers to transforming the signal from one form into another, relaying that information. And we've talked about signals already, signal molecules, right? Several times in several examples, in different chapters. Remember what I've said several times, namely that any signal molecule, whether it's a hormone, a neurotransmitter, a drug, whatever, is not going to have any effect unless it binds to a receptor. Well, some signal molecules have their effect by entering the cell, and that's where, inside the cell, is where they find their receptor. Actually, it's a fairly small percentage of the kinds of signals that do that, though, because they have to be the right type of particle that can actually enter the cell. Most of our signals, including most of our hormones, actually never enter the cell. They're blocked from actually getting in. Nevertheless, they have a strong effect as hormones simply by knocking on the door, more or less. They, of course, have to have a receptor, but in this case, the receptor is a membrane-bound receptor. And just like in the case of a transport protein, which has to be transmembrane for it to work, it has to go all the way through the thickness, so does a signal transduction protein. It has to go all the way through the thickness. It has to have a part of the signal receptor facing the exterior, because that's where the signals will be if they're present, right? And so that's where the shape has to be that will receive that signal. In this case, that triangular shape. Signal molecule can't get in. Now, signals are examples of ligands, which is just a general word meaning something that binds to a protein. What did I say is the general consequence of any ligand, signal or otherwise, binding to a protein? What happens? What does that binding event cause directly? It causes a conformational change in the protein. What does that mean? What is the conformation of a protein? It's another name for its shape. So when a ligand in general, including a signal, binds to a protein, that binding causes the protein to change shape. If this were a peripheral protein or an integral protein that's not transmembrane, if it just went halfway through the thickness, it could bind to the signal, and that would cause the protein to change shape, but the things inside the cell would never know about that, right? It has to be transmembrane, because when it changes shape in response to the signal that can't get in the cell, the shape changes such that this part of the same protein that's facing the interior also changes shape. And therefore, it can interact with things inside the cell differently from how it would interact with them, if at all, if the signal weren't there outside the cell. Does that make sense? It's relaying the message. The signal's job is done, but whatever that shape change causes can, in effect, create a new signal inside the cell called a second messenger, which then will interact with something else and so on. There might be several steps until you finally get to whatever the ultimate effect is of that signal originally. Okay, D is cell-to-cell recognition, which is not something that applies to unicellular organisms, but for us multicellular organisms, it's important. As we've said, we are trillions of cells per individual. But not only that, we are multiple different types of cells, right? We're not trillions of duplicate cells. Our neurons are totally different from our kidney cells and so on, doing different functions. But for us to operate and remain alive as an individual, it's important for our cells to recognize each other as being part of the same individual. In other words, it's important in a multicellular organism for individual cells to recognize the difference between self and non-self cells. Non-self cells are invaders, potentially. And so maybe it's appropriate to attack those. But you don't want your cells to attack your own cells, which is what happens in an autoimmune disorder. Right? So you want their cells to recognize that other cell is part of the same team, basically. And that's using different membrane-bound proteins to do that. So these are two different cells in Part D of the same multicellular organism. Notice this is labeled as a glycoprotein. The glyco part of that means sugar, like in glycosidic linkage. So it's a protein connected to a sugar externally. And this is more or less acting as an ID badge. Specifically, the sugar part of it is like the name on the ID badge. And then a totally different protein in the other cell has the right shape to recognize that sugar part of the glycoprotein in the first cell, which means it's saying, okay, I'm not going to kill you, you're one of us. Next is intercellular joining, which also involves proteins that are parts of different cells, but for a different reason. This is to keep them together, not to recognize them, just to anchor them in place. And what did we see as animal examples of this? What were the things called in animals that do just this function? Intercellular junctions in animal cells that keep them together. Those are the desmosomes, remember, from that picture. I think it was the previous chapter. Okay, next and final one in eight is attachment to the cytoskeleton and the extracellular matrix, which is more or less strain relief. Right? You have a set of proteins exterior to the cell. That's part of the extracellular matrix. Some of those proteins are connected directly to transmembrane proteins in the membrane on the exterior side, and then that transmembrane protein in turn is connected to proteins making up the cytoskeleton on the inside. So if something pulls on this, for instance, from outside, it's not going to easily rip the plasma membrane, which is flimsy, because that pulling force is going to be transferred through the transmembrane protein to the strong cytoskeletal elements inside. Strain relief. Okay, now to nine. Well, I talked about this in words in a different chapter. Unfortunately, that chapter didn't have this picture. So I've really explained this before, but it's good to see a picture. This goes back to the functions of the endoplasmic the rough endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi complex. The rough ER, of course, modifies newly made proteins and then packages them in a vesicle made out of its own membrane. Those vesicles are then received by the cis face of the Golgi complex, and then it figures out where they need to go and packages them in new vesicles made out of Golgi membrane. But here's where I didn't have a picture of both of the possibilities before, but I told you that it could happen. Notice that some of these proteins are fully enclosed inside the vesicle. So when the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane and then just becomes part of the plasma membrane, those ones that were entirely within the vesicle will be entirely spilled out of the cell, exported. But the ones that are the one that's shaped like a barbell here, or a dumbbell, that's actually a membrane-bound vesicle protein, right? It's part of the vesicle's membrane. So when it fuses, or when that same vesicle fuses, that will now become part of the plasma membrane itself rather than export it all the way out. And so this is how the cell is continuously adjusting what the components of the plasma membrane are moment to moment. Not only adjusting the phospholipids, you know, getting ones that are saturated or unsaturated into the plasma membrane, but also adjusting which specific proteins are embedded in the membrane. 10, 11, and 12 we have already covered, so we can breeze past those. Just remember that it's examination material. And we can, that'll bring us to 13. In 13, we're looking at a protist. Now, protist is a kind of a catch-all word in classification. It used to mean something different, but nowadays, protist means any organism that is a eukaryote, but is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. So, of course, bacteria aren't protists because they're not eukaryotes, right? But there are plenty of things within eukarya, the domain, besides animals, plants, and fungi, and all of those things together are classified as protists. Well, there are some big protists, multicellular. You know, they're huge algae, for instance. Those are protists. But there are also some unicellular protists, and that's what we're looking at here. So it just lives as one cell. And more specifically than that, this is an aquatic protist. Now, what does aquatic mean in this case? Yeah, it refers to water, but we use two different terms typically in biology, either aquatic or marine. What is the difference between those? Well, no, it has to do with the actual water itself. Right, marine is salt water. Aquatic is fresh water, so lakes and streams. And so, having been through last week's lab exercise, you should realize that an aquatic environment and a marine environment are drastically different in terms of tonicity, right? This is an aquatic protist, so it lives in fresh water. How would you classify fresh water in terms of tonicity? Well, what are the possibilities for tonicity? Hypotonic, hypertonic, isotonic. Which of those three do you think an aquatic environment is? It could be iso, depending on, of course, the solute concentration, but usually it's hypo. It's not pure water, of course, which is the most hypotonic you can get, but it's because it's fresh water, it is mostly water, therefore hypotonic. Now, that would be no problem for a plant cell, as we discussed, or a bacterium, because they have a cell wall, right? Hypotonic environment is going to cause a tendency continuously for water to enter the cell, right? By definition of hypotonicity. Wouldn't be a problem for a bacterium or a plant. It would be a problem for an animal cell, right? Because an animal cell doesn't have a cell wall. It has only a flimsy plasma membrane that can't hold that pressure. That's why animal cells, like a blood cell that I use as an example, undergo lysis in a hypotonic environment. They explode because they can't hold that water. Well, this aquatic protist, just like an animal cell, has only a plasma membrane. It doesn't have a cell wall. Yet it lives in an environment in which water is going to continuously being added to the cell. Now, we can live with the death of a few million red blood cells. That's not going to hurt us because we have so many, right? But this is a unicellular organism. If it loses one cell, it no longer exists. So it can't undergo lysis at all. And the reason it doesn't, despite continuous influx of water osmotically, is that it has a specialized organelle called a contractile vacuole that features microfilaments, just like the ones that cause our muscles to contract that I've talked about earlier. But otherwise, it's a little bag made out of membrane. Water is continuously coming into the cell and into the contractile vacuole. So the contractile vacuole is always growing, but it stretches to a certain limit, and that's what causes the contraction automatically, and it squeezes, forcing the water out. So it just does this over and over for the whole lifetime of the cell, operating as a bilge pump, continuously removing water that shouldn't be there. Okay. Now to 14, and we need to take a closer look at transmembrane transport. I mentioned in lab that there are three major categories of transport processes that can take things into the cell or move them out of the cell. Do you remember what those three are?
Active and
vesicular. Exactly right. Yes. Vesicular transport, though, as I've called it, is kind of like a cheating mechanism, because even though something goes into or out of the cell, it never really crosses a membrane, right? So vesicular transport, even though it's a transport process and important, is not actually transmembrane transport. Transmembrane transport refers to something crossing the membrane itself, going either into or out of the cell. And so that includes the other two, passive transport and active transport. Now, the distinction between those is whether or not there is a need for additional energy beyond what's already built into the system. There's energy required for both passive and active, as I've said in lab. Nothing moves for free. But in passive transport, there's enough built-in energy. And what is the form of the built-in energy?
Gradient.
The gradient, the concentration gradient. Gradients are sources of energy. Keep that in mind. We're going to be talking about it a lot more. They can therefore do some work for you. Okay, so passive transport is just movement from high to low concentration based on the direction of the gradient. And if that happens through a membrane, then it's passive transmembrane transport. Active transport, on the other hand, moves things against the gradient. Exactly opposite of the way they would like to move because of their gradient. And that's never going to happen using built-in energy. The built-in energy, you have to fight, because the built-in energy, the gradient, is trying to move them down their gradient. In order for you to successfully move them against their gradient, you have to put in even more energy than the gradient has trying to move them in the opposite way. So that's the distinction between active and passive transport, which is not really the main theme of slide 14, but it's going to become important. 14 is really, though, about transport proteins themselves. And there are two major categories. So first of all, a transport protein might not even be necessary. It's always going to be necessary in active transport. It's not always necessary in passive transport. Because if the particle type, whatever it is, happens to be one of those particle types that can easily get directly through the phospholipid bilayer, then you don't need a transport protein. It'll just go through the membrane, through the phospholipid bilayer. A lot of particles, though, can't get directly through the membrane, which is why I keep saying that you can't have a complete membrane be nothing but phospholipids. So those kind of particles, if they're going to move into or out of the cell, they need the help of a so-called transport protein, which can also just be called transporters. All right. So the purple things are membrane-bound transport proteins. And as I said in an earlier slide, a transport protein has to be transmembrane, right? Otherwise, it's not going to get the thing all the way through the membrane, either into or out of the cell. Okay, so this is really not about whether it's passive or active. This is about how the individual transport protein works. On the top, we have a channel protein. That's one of the major categories of transport proteins. And that one with the ribbon model was an example of this. Here we have a cutaway view, and you can see that it is just a tunnel It's like a bead designed for stringing. It has a hollow center where the string would go through. So it's just a tunnel. That doesn't mean that just anything is allowed through it. It has to still be the correct kind of particle. But it's an open channel. Now, some channel proteins are continuously open. Some of them are gated, so a gate can either open or close. But even if they're gated, when it's open, it's just a channel, and the protein does not change shape. The tunnel walls don't get deformed. They're just walls. And that's why it's called a channel. On the other hand, the other category is a carrier protein. Carrier proteins are transport proteins that temporarily interact with the solute or particle type being transported. So they're not just continuously open tunnels. They actually temporarily bind to the particle being transported and then unbind it in a way that delivers it onto the other side. This is yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? What do I keep saying is the general consequence of that? A ligand binding to a protein? A shape change, a conformational change. Well, that's how carrier proteins operate, by changing their shape in response to that particle type binding to it temporarily. Okay, now, that's just a distinction based on whether or not they change shape to operate. It has nothing to do with active or passive. More about that in a slide that's coming up. But first, let's take a look at a specific example of a carrier protein. This one is very plentiful in your own body. We're on slide 15. This is the sodium-potassium exchange pump, which is the main kind of pump in animals. Before I go on, I just use the word pump. We use the word pump to refer to a transporter that operates via active transport. Okay? And by analogy with a real pump. You know, you don't have to help water downhill. It's just going to fall. That's passive transport. It's going down its gradient. In this case, gravitational gradient. But if you want to move water uphill, you're going to have to put some energy into it, right? Either pumping with your hand on a pump or an electrical pump or whatever, right? So you have to force it against gravity, against the way it wants to move naturally. That's active transport by definition. So when a transport protein is used for active transport as opposed to passive, then we call that transporter a pump. This is your most prevalent pump in your body. There are quadrillions of these in your body. All your living cells basically have these, many of these. The sodium-potassium exchange pump is called that because really it's two pumps in one. It pumps both sodium ions and potassium ions more or less at the same time, but in opposite directions. It's pumping them both, though, because it's moving each of them in the way it does not want to move based on its gradient. So it goes in a cycle. That's the six parts here, as you see. But each completion of a cycle will force sodium ions out of the cell and force potassium ions into the cell. I say force them because there's already a high concentration of sodium ions outside compared to in. If you move more out, you're doing exactly the opposite of what diffusion would do, right? That's what makes it active transport. That's never going to happen for free. The gradient's going to fight that. That's why you have to input some form of energy, in this case ATP. But potassium is also going against its gradient because there's already a high concentration of potassium inside the cell, low concentration outside. If you put more in, you're going against the gradient. So it's two pumps in one, but this thing is so prevalent in your body that by some estimates, 40%, almost half of the reason that you eat, 40% of your energy budget goes into just continuously operating these things for your whole lifetime. They never stop. But anyway, that's That's an example of a carrier protein used as active transport. Now, any pump, which I said is an active transporter, right, has to be a carrier protein. It can't be a channel protein. Because if you have a channel, it's just an open hole, right? Things are just going to spill through it down the gradient. If you have a barrel full of water and you just put a hole into it, that's not a good way of getting water into the barrel, right? It's going to come out down its gradient. To force water against its gradient, you have to grab onto the water and put it in. That requires something that's actually going to grab onto the particle, which is what a carrier protein does. So only carrier proteins can be used for active transport, but carrier proteins can also be used for passive transport. If you have a gradient in place and the particle simply can't get through the phospholipid bilayer, but it can bind to a carrier protein temporarily, which then changes shape and delivers it to the other side, as long as it's still going down its gradient, that's still passive transport. A channel protein obviously can be used for passive transport, right? As long as there's a gradient and it's the right kind of thing to get through the channel, it's going to do it. What's going to determine whether it goes into or out of the cell through a channel? What is going to determine whether a solute particle, whatever it is going to go into or out of the cell through a channel? Exactly. The direction of the concentration gradient is the only thing that determines the direction in all cases of passive transport. Okay, so it's just an open hole. If there's a higher concentration inside the cell than out, it's going to leave the cell. Okay, so but a channel protein can never work for active transport. It can only work for passive transport. A carrier protein could be used for either. Let's take a look at these two major categories of transport in 16 and just what can be used for each of them. Passive transport is diffusion. So it's based on a gradient. So the gradient has to be in place first for there to be net diffusion. But that can happen in two major ways. One way is to just go directly through the phospholipid bilayer, like certain things can, involving no membrane-bound transport protein. What has to be true of those particles for them to be able to do that? Two things. They need to be small enough, because if you're too big, you're just going to be blocked. And smallness isn't enough by itself. You also need to be more or less neutral, not polar, in other words, not polar or not charged. If you're small enough and nonpolar enough, then you can slip right through. Oxygen and carbon dioxide do this all the time in your cells continuously because they're small and nonpolar. On the other hand, if you are either too big or too polar or both big and polar, you're not going to get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. If there's a gradient in place, though, and a way for you to get from A to B, diffusion will happen, remember. It's just not direct diffusion like through the phospholipid bilayer. Instead, it has to be with the help or the facilitation of a membrane-bound transport protein, which is why that form of diffusion, which still is diffusion, passive, is called facilitated diffusion. Facilitated diffusion is diffusion through a membrane using the help of a transport protein of some sort. And it can be either a channel or a carrier protein, as you see here. Active transport, on the other hand, would never work directly through the phospholipid bilayer, right? It's just going to leak in whichever direction the gradient says. It's not going to ever move in the opposite direction. So it has to have a transport protein for it to be active transport, and it can't be a channel because, once again, it's just going to leak down the gradient. Instead, you have to actually grab onto the thing and force it the opposite way at the expense of energy. That's what ATP is about here. and we call those things pumps. Okay, now to 17. This features a different kind of pump. You have these in your own body as well, but this is the main kind of pump found in plants. They don't, instead of using sodium-potassium exchange pumps like we animals do, they use mostly proton pumps, but we have both. Anyway, that doesn't actually matter what kind of pump it is. This just happens to be a proton pump in this example. And keep in mind that a proton, a hydrogen ion, and an H plus are all the same exact thing, right? So these H pluses are hydrogen ions. They are also called protons. It's simply a proton by itself. Well, this is a pump, meaning that it's an active transporter. So there has to be some energy involved. That's what the ATP is about. ATP is frequently the energy source, but not always. In this case, it is, though. And in this case, the direction of pumping is that it takes them from the inside, the protons from the inside of the cell, pumps them outwardly. Now, you need energy to do this because as you continue to do this, there's going to be a tendency for these protons to want to come back in, right? This brings up an important point about pumps. Not only are they active transporters, but by operating, they produce and maintain gradients. This gradient didn't exist originally, right? Imagine it having the same concentration of protons on each side. Because of this pump operating at the expense of ATP, it now has created the condition where you have a higher concentration on one side and a lower concentration on the other side. It created the gradient. And what do I keep telling you to remember about gradients? They're energy sources. They can do things for you. So that's going to be important in the next slide. But this active transport, which we would usually just call active transport, could also be called primary active transport. Now, the only reason I'm using the word primary here is because I want to distinguish it from what's going to be called in the next slide, secondary active transport. What makes this primary active transport is that the external energy source, which in this case is ATP, is used directly to power the pump. Okay? But, as I was just saying a moment ago, if you keep doing that, if you keep operating this pump, yes, you're spending some energy in the form of ATP, but a lot of that energy is now being stored in the form of the gradient that you produce. And that gradient can therefore do some work for you. That's what secondary active transport is all about, which is in slide 18. But actually, there's both primary and secondary here. The proton pump shown in 18 is exactly the same pump we just looked at in 17. And if you consider that just in isolation, as we did in the previous slide, that's just an example of primary active transport. On the bottom, though, you have a different, right next to it on the membrane, kind of protein acting as a pump as well, but this one operates via secondary active transport. Now, I'll get back to the distinction between primary and secondary in a second, but let me give you a couple more definitions about transporters in general. Some transporters, and this has nothing to do with whether they're active or passive, some transporters are classified as uniporters. That's the actual protein itself. The process is called uniport. But a uniporter is simply a transport protein that moves just one kind of particle. Many of them, but they're all the same kind of particle. And notice I didn't say anything about the direction. It's just one kind of particle that it operates on, like the proton pump. But if the proton pump were pumping them into the cell instead of out, it would still be a uniporter. Then there are transport proteins that simultaneously, more or less simultaneously, transport two different kinds of particles. And those are called co-transporters, as the one that you see here. Co means share, right? But when it comes to co-transporters, since two particle types are involved, there are two possibilities. So I'm going to subdivide co-transporters into two subcategories. If the two different types of particles move in the same direction as each other, either both into or both out of the cell, then we call that a symporter. The transport protein itself would be called a symporter. Sim meaning same or together. The only other possibility for a co-transporter is that the two different particles move in opposite directions with respect to each other. And in that case, the co-transporter is more specifically called an antiporter. Anti meaning against. So, based on those definitions, this sucrose proton co-transporter that's in the bottom of the picture is what kind of co-transporter? It's a symporter because both the sucrose and the protons are moving in the same direction. If they were both being exported, they would still be a symporter because they're moving in the same direction as each other. It has nothing to do with their going in or out. But think back to the sodium-potassium exchange pump that we looked at. That's a co-transporter that's an antiporter because the sodium's going out and the potassium's going in. Okay, now with those definitions out of the way, let's get back to this distinction between primary and secondary active transport. The sucrose, which is table sugar, the green disaccharide that you see here, it's not obvious from the picture, but it's being pumped. And remember, I said pumping is active transport, right? What they should have drawn better is the fact that there's already a high concentration of sucrose inside the cell. And you're adding even more to that. So sucrose is being pumped. It's going against its gradient, right? It wants to spill out. It's locked in the cell, but you're adding even more to it. So no pumping is ever free. Pumping is always active transport. Notice, though, that there's no ATP being used here to force that sucrose inward. There has to be an energy source, though, for active transport, or it won't happen. What is the source of the energy to drive sucrose inward? Well, what about the hydrogen? What is the actual energy source? Well, that's what the hydrogen ions are, the protons. No? What do I keep telling you to remember?
The gradient.
Gradients are forms of energy. Yes, it's the proton gradient that is forcing the sucrose in. So the proton pump is operating by primary active transport because the external energy, ATP in this case, is directly powering that pump. But as I said in the previous slide, the energy that you use in the form of ATP creates the proton gradient to begin with, and that gradient is now stored energy. Some of the energy that was in the ATP is now in the form of a proton gradient. And that means now there is a tendency, the gradient is the tendency, for protons to diffuse down their gradient, which would be back into the cell, right? Why don't they just slip right through the plasma, the phospholipid bilayer? Right down their gradient. Why don't the protons just go right back into the cell, slipping right through the phospholipid bilayer? No, they're small. They're smaller than almost every atom. Well, they are smaller than every atom. And much smaller than any molecule. It's just a single proton.
Are they too polar?
Yes, they are an ion. They're beyond polar. They're fully charged. So they don't want to be around those tails. And therefore, almost none of them actually do leak directly through the phospholipid bilayer. They want to, because of their gradient, get into the cell. But in this case, the cell is set up so that there's only one easy way to do that, namely through this cotransporter. So hydrogen ions are diffusing back into the cell. That's passive with respect to the protons, hydrogen ions. But when they do that, they drag sucrose along for the ride, going against their own gradient. So sucrose is being pumped, powered by the diffusion of protons, which you wouldn't have unless you first set up the gradient for protons by primary active transport. The external form of energy, the original source of energy for all of this, is the ATP in this case. But it's not directly powering this pump. It's indirectly powering this pump. That's why it's called secondary active transport. Is all that clear? Okay. Let's go then to the final slide of the unit, 19, which is a revisit and some additional pictures of vesicular transport. We've discussed this pretty much before. Remember that vesicular transport is that third category that can get things into or out of cells. That's a broad category. Anything that moves particles into or out of cells using a vesicle to do so is broadly categorized as vesicular transport. But we can subdivide that, right, into categories. What are the two major categories of vesicular transport? Anyone remember? No idea?
It's when they're all enclosed and versus.
The distinction, it's using a vesicle in both cases.
Yeah.
The distinction for the two major subdivisions is the direction of transport. In other words, whether it's into the cell using a vesicle or out of the cell using a vesicle. So does that help you remember? The two types are called exocytosis and endocytosis. Exo means out. Cyte means cell, osis means condition. So exocytosis is outward vesicular transport. Endocytosis is inward vesicular transport. When we looked at that vesicle spilling out its proteins, that was exocytosis because it was moving things out of the cell. Here we're looking at endocytosis in all three of these pictures. But endocytosis, even though that's a subdivision of vesicular transport, can then further be subdivided based not on the direction, because it's inward in both cases, but based on the nature of the thing being sent into the cell. We talked about this earlier as well. When you use endocytosis to bring in a solid chunk or chunks, it's like eating versus drinking, so it's called phagocytosis, which is endocytosis of a solid particles. But sometimes a cell will just use the same process to take little sips of the liquid exterior, bringing them in vesicles. So that's still endocytosis, but it's more like drinking than eating, and so it's called pinocytosis, literally cell drinking. All right, that's the only distinction, whether it's solid or liquid. Some cells, by the way, will be more or less continuously doing this pinocytosis, taking little sips continuously, kind of hoping something that's there that's valuable, let's say. On the other hand, there's a more specific type of endocytosis called receptor-mediated endocytosis. Mediated means that there's something else involved, namely a receptor. That's what these red things are. So in this case, the cell doesn't bother to make a vesicle unless it's first sure that the right stuff is present for it to import. If it's not there, it won't make the, it won't go through the energy, won't waste the energy to make the vesicle. And the way that it's able to tell that the right stuff is there is that these receptors are specific for just the right kind of particles in the exterior. In this case, the purple triangles. If they're there, they bind to the receptor. Once again, that's a ligand binding to a protein. That causes a shape change in the protein. That's how the cell finds out, okay, that right stuff is there, and therefore it makes a vesicle and brings it inward. That is the chapter, and therefore the unit. So we're done in here. Yeah.
Could you repeat what you said about secondary transport?
Yeah, let me go back to the picture to make it more obvious. Secondary active transport is active transport of a particle using as the source of energy a gradient that is established by a different pump operating via primary transport, primary active transport. So ATP is necessary here for sucrose, but not directly, not primarily, right? It's directly powering the proton pump. And then the proton pump creates the gradient, which is now the form of energy that drives directly the sucrose pump. But if you didn't have the ATP to begin with, then you wouldn't have that gradient and the sucrose pump would shut down. Yeah.
So why not just cut out the proton pump? Keep the hydrogen where it is. This is the ATP part of
itself. Well, because a proton pump can establish a gradient that's useful for multiple different kinds of pumps like this. So you don't have to have a specific pump working directly with ATP for many different kinds of particles. This happens in your kidneys, for instance. Protons being pumped around can drive all kinds of different processes. Was there a hand over here? All right, then I'll see you in the laboratory.